Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear radio program. I am your host, Susan Laris and Danz, and I am delighted to welcome all of you to the new fall season of the show. And we have quite a few very interesting and engaging programs coming up. The intent of this show, just to remind the new listeners out there, is to really enter into that space where many fear to go. That space of understanding that which divides us so that we can at least begin to communicate, so that we can at least begin to glimpse what the other person is thinking, what are their motivations, and even more importantly, what are they feeling. And so I'd have to say that we couldn't have a more appropriate guest to launch the first season, or the second season of this show. Actually, we're entering into the third season now. I'm losing track of time, but we could not have a better guest to launch this series of programs than Douglas Knoll. Douglas Knoll is an internationally recognized mediator and peacemaker. He is the author of the 2011 book, Elusive Peace: How Modern Diplomatic Strategies Can Better Resolve World Conflicts. And this book won the 2011 International Peace and Justice Book Award. Doug is an adjunct professor of law. He has a master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies. And he was a business and commercial trial lawyer for 22 years before turning to peacemaking. He is a fellow of the International Academy of Mediators, a fellow of the American College of Civil Trial Mediators, and he's on the American Arbitration Association panel of mediators and arbitrators. He was also one of the first mediators certified under international standards established by the International Mediation Institute. Now, one aspect of Doug's work that is truly exemplary, and I know that we will explore today, is his work as co-founder of the Prison of Peace Project, teaching mediation skills to prisoners. For this work, Doug was awarded the 2012 California Attorney of the Year Award. Doug's specialty is in difficult, complex, and intractable conflicts. And he's also the 2012 president of the California Dispute Resolution Council. Doug hosts his own online radio show, which is called The Doug Knoll Show. And he's written other books as well, including Sex, Politics, and Religion at the Office, and Peacemaking, Practicing at the Intersection of Law and Human Conflict. He and his wife, Alea Dow, have also launched webinars on relationships, basically taking those peacemaking skills and applying them to our relationships on a one-on-one basis. So today, we are going to talk about not only how we can approach and heal the rifts in our society, but we'll also touch upon how that reflects upon our personal lives. Where does all of this start in our personal relationships? And I do want to point out that Doug's website is www.elusivepeace.com. There's also a site for the Prison of Peace Project, which is very interesting, which is www.prisonofpeace.org. And for our Portland listeners, because I know that we do have quite a few, this show originates out of the Portland, Oregon area, Doug will be appearing next week, a week from today, at Concordia College at 7 p.m., and he's going to be teaching How Peace is Possible. He will be discussing this, and it's a free talk that you can attend if you're in the Pacific Northwest. Now, I wanted to let you know that there is a chat room open for today's show, should you like to pass on some questions to the guest. There is also a call-in number, which is 310-807-5104. Doug is with us for the next hour. I suspect we will not run out of things to talk about because we're going to talk about the elections, we're going to talk about the world, and we're going to talk about personal relationships. So without further delay, I am delighted to bring Doug Knoll back on the program. Welcome back, Doug.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
You know, those intros just keep getting longer and longer. I'm going to run out of breath with all the accolades to describe.
Yeah, well, you don't have to say it all, you know. I mean,
you know, what's so funny about this show, I have to tell you, is that I am such a spontaneous radio host. Sometimes I just want to throw the sheets away where I've prepared, you know, all the list of accomplishments and really get at the heart of the matter. But because this show is all about authenticity and really, you know, getting at these topics from the heart. And I have to say that I revisited your book, Elusive Peace. I had read it before you came on the show last time, which is a while back, and I reread it again. And it gets even more applicable as the world evolves, as we're looking at the current election season and these rifts that are apparent within our society, these perceived rifts. I can see even more just how appropriate some of these techniques are that you discuss in your book.
They're fundamental. And the sad thing is that we have the capacity to do this work, but it's not innate. So we have to learn how to do this stuff, and we have to practice it until it becomes a conscious habit. And so part of the problem that we have in the world is that because people have not learned these skills and have not made them habitual, they revert back to their, you know, their basic biology, which is fear response. And, you know, hence the title of your show. when you're unconscious and default back to your fear response, you know, you get all kinds of suboptimal. It's great when you have to leap away from the rattlesnake, but it's not so great when you've got to deal with a complex problem involving a lot of emotionality.
You know, this is an interesting thing that you raise. Given that fear is really palpable in our society right now, given all that's going on, it seems like, you know, it's all we can do moment by moment to hold fear at bay, which is what this show is about. This show is not about perfection in dealing with fear, because I don't think any of us have accomplished that, but it's about finding that space moment by moment where we can work through our fear. But I'm wondering, is it because we are so afraid right now, because there are so many things to be afraid about if you choose to be, is that why the risks are surfacing even more?
I don't think so. I think it's different. Because when you think about it, here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and at least in this country, in the United States, there are very few people who have any physical, really have physical fear. I mean, there's very little likelihood that anybody's going to starve to death. There's very little likelihood that somebody's not going to get some kind of basic emergency medical care if they need it. There are very few people, relatively speaking, I'm talking relative now, there are very few people who are without a home. So in terms of our physical needs, we live in a land of great abundance. Yes, there are population groups, and I happen to live in the poorest congressional district in the United States, so I know firsthand that there are pockets of poverty and suffering, but generally speaking, our physical needs are well taken care of. So it's not a fear. I don't think the fear that we're looking at is a fear, a physical fear like stepping onto a rattlesnake. I think it's deeper than that, and I think it's more complex, and it's much, much more difficult to deal with. And that is the fear that we have is the fear of loss of identity. And we know that when people form identities about who they are and what their roles are in life, if they have a very narrow definition of who they are and what their identity is, a challenge to that identity sets off a fear reaction as if they were being, you know, they were getting close to a rattlesnake. And so the biological reaction to an identity attack is essentially the same as, you know, facing a mountain lion or a bear or a rattlesnake. And so people become very self-protective unconsciously, and they lash out and say stupid things and act in extremely emotional ways that essentially shuts down their prefrontal cortex so they can no longer, you know, use any kind of executive function in their problem solving. But it's this fear around identity challenge, and we see this, I mean, the political discourse that we're seeing is such a perfect example of that, where people have extremely limited and narrow identities that that anybody who is different than they are challenges that identity by saying, you know, it's possible for there to be other identities that are just as legitimate. Makes people go into huge fear. So it's a psychological fear that our culture has developed, not a physical fear. And that's a really challenging problem to deal with.
So I guess in a way we've transcended, in some ways, survival mode, although right now I know there are people who are struggling. Like you said, you live in a poor district, and we do see that even within middle-class communities like where I live, a lot of people are struggling. But it's not the same, as you say, like centuries ago when every moment you feared for your life. We intellectualize
even the poorest person in the United States would be considered quite well off in, for example, Somalia. I mean, it's all relative. I don't think it's the physical fear, it's the psychological fear that we have. And I think if we're looking at this problem from the perspective of, from my perspective as a peacemaker, is what is it that has caused these narrow identities, and how can we help people build broader, more complex identities that gives them the elasticity to deal with identity challenges? And that's really the secret here.
Do you feel, Doug, that part of the problem is that we are expanding as a society what more of us are willing to accept, and that then makes narrower groups much more threatened? They feel like they're just going to be excluded from where society is heading. I mean, I guess the classic would be in the 1960s, if anyone even talked about gay marriage, that would not have been even an acceptable topic to discuss at all, whereas now that is expanding. Why is that so threatening, things like that? And is it because of identity?
Perfect example. So as some segments of our society gain more broader identities and see the possibility for different kinds of relationships, and we'll just take marriage as an example because it's such a hot button.
Yeah.
And we talk about gay marriage. There are many, many other people who do not live in a culture that is multilingual, multi-diverse, multicultural. Many people live in a monocultural existence. It might be within their faith tradition. It might be that they live in a small town. It might be they live in a rural area, or they live in a part of the country where everybody's pretty much the same ethnicity and has the same basic beliefs. And so those people see the world from their perspective, which is natural, but they do not see the multicultural perspective of the people that might live, say, in New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco or Portland or Seattle. And so what happens is, because they see the world, they see any idea, any concept of identity that is different, radically different than what they see, is automatically in the middle parts of their brain, the emotional center of the brain, is immediately construed as a threat. And so they feel this anxiety around, for example, the idea of gay marriage, and that anxiety gets interpreted as a fear or a danger, and then it gets further identified as, as people start to articulate the fear, they say, well, if we allow gay marriage, that will mean the end of marriage as we know it. My whole life is based on this idea of the nuclear family, man, woman, kids, you know, leave it to Beaver, and therefore, I am now interpreting all of this associatively as gay marriage equaling the end of marriage or the end of my meaning, the meaning of my existence. And so everything that creates meaning for me now no longer has meaning. And that's an existential threat. It means that I no longer have a meaning, and at some primal level, there is a sense of annihilation of identity, which is death.
Yeah.
And so people don't take the time to articulate this. They don't take the time to go through and really try to understand, why is it that I'm so afraid of gay marriage? What is it about this that really is getting me triggered? It's extremely difficult to get people to even engage in that kind of discussion. And pick any hot button topic, you'll see the same thing, whether it's, you know, gun rights, or it's abortion versus, pro-life, pro-choice, or whether it's gay marriage, or whether it's healthcare, or whether it's taxes, or whether it's Obama versus Romney, it's the same dynamic going on. And so the people who are threatened, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I was just wondering, how much does clinging to a particular belief system, you know, static belief, so that someone will say, it says in, you know, name your sacred book, whatever it is, something
exactly.
that they hold sacred,
right.
And this can, it doesn't have to be a religious book. It can be some creed,
right.
you know. How does that enter into the equation? Is it something that
it's
they
the
just
same.
Fall back on and cling
Great
to?
Great question. It is exactly the same thing. Because what happens is, when you have a narrow identity and you are using, ideology becomes a substitute for critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than deal with the internal anxiety of a complex, ambiguous, difficult, many times unsolvable cultural problem, you can revert to ideology, whether it be scripture or political ideology or economic ideology. You can revert to a very simplistic way of looking at the world. That's what ideology is. It's very simplistic. And the ideology supplies all of the answers for you. It provides certitude, and thereby reduces the anxiety that you're experiencing around the complexity and ambiguity of the world, and you feel good.
Yeah.
So when we fail to teach our kids, I got a great story. I mean, when we don't fail to teach our kids how to critically think, what we do, their only real psychological option is to adopt ideology. And here's the story that really brought this home to me. I was in Iowa last year teaching advanced mediation to a bunch of really high-level mediators in Iowa. And one of the guys, we were driving out dinner one night, and one of the guys was talking. I said, what's going on here with Iowa, with all the, you know, evangelicals and the Christian right and all that stuff? He said, well, what's really interesting is that most of it's in the west part of the state. Most of the people that have those beliefs are between 35 and 55 years old, and they're highly ideological, good people, all of them. But what's really interesting is we can trace the development of their Christian ideology to the demise of the Iowan educational system, because we used to teach critical thinking here, and we don't teach critical thinking anymore, and ideology has replaced critical thinking in the western part of the state.
Wow, that's really interesting. You know, as I listen to various conservative talk show hosts just to get a feel for what they're saying, and you know what, Doug, something that I have heard, and this has been discussed more than once, is that they are afraid of their children learning critical thinking. In fact, they've even spoken out against the educational institutions. They're very afraid of their kids going to college. I've heard Glenn Beck
right.
say, you know, watch out. If your kids go to college, they're going to lose track of everything you've taught them. And that's
right.
why I've heard Glenn Beck say that you need to homeschool your kids precisely
right.
so that they don't get exposed to these ideas, and he viewed it as another form of indoctrination, that if they go to the public
right.
school, they're going to be indoctrinated into that way of thinking, and
so,
yet the irony is they're indoctrinating their kids and don't want
course.
Them to think.
Well, it's not that they don't want them to think, it's they want them to think in a very narrow ideological way, because to think in any other way is threatening. Since they have such narrow identities, remember, this is all psychological, they have such narrow identities, any idea that threatens the validity or potential truth of that identity is looks like it's murder. It looks like it's a really identity homicide. And that's extremely threatening, and it happens all at the unconscious level. People aren't even aware that this is happening. I mean, so that's why we have the whole creationism versus evolution debate. You know, it goes all the way back to the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1928. When Clarence Darrow, that famous Clarence Darrow William Jennings Bryan trial that Darrow won. I mean, it comes back to the idea of can we hold multiple, even conflicting beliefs and ideas in our head at the same time? And the answer is yes, we can, but it's difficult, and it takes a lot of training and education to be able to do that.
You know,
as long as you can only hold one idea in your head at a time, there's no room for any contradictory ideas or more complex ideas. So you have to learn how to do it all, and that's what education is all about, and it's very tough for people to do that.
Yeah, it's a complex process, and you know, I've often thought when I've heard this sort of thing, there is a certain irony to it, because these same people, and you know, I have found, I will tell you, I listen to these different people, and I have found, and I'm going to get myself into trouble probably just by saying this, but it's true, I have found something positive and to admire in each and every one, and I believe they are capable of understanding the other side of the equation. And one of the questions that I've often had and would love to ask is that if they want to isolate their children so much, or even themselves, they might be the first people to tell you that they actually believe in a God of free choice, or of a, you know, where you choose what you will believe. And that's very important to many evangelicals. And I know, because I grew up as an evangelical and was told that many times, that, you know, we are supposed to be free to make choices. And so my question would be, if we are free to make choices, then why not provide all of the information so that someone can actually make a free choice? Because if you isolate that information to a very narrow creed, that's not really modeling what they themselves would say God has done with the world. So,
well, of course, you're asking a very system two brain kind of thinking, which is, you know, higher executive function. I don't like to use the terms rational and irrational, but it's clearly high level executive thinking that you're engaging in when you ask that question. And the answer to the question is people may be able to intellectually ask that question, but their emotional response is so visceral, it's so powerful because of the fear reaction, that it literally shuts down the part of their brain that can answer that question in a rational, logical way. The people are being hijacked by their emotions, and in particular, they're being hijacked by their fear system. And so, when you are fearful that an idea, when an idea emotionally is just as threatening to you as a rattlesnake or a grizzly bear, you have no room to puzzle through the problem and think about what's going on. The only room you have in your brain is to fight or to run like hell. And that's what we see in these people. We see the Glenn Becks of the world, or the Bill O'Reillys, the Fox News people. It's all about fear.
Yeah.
You don't see anything on Fox News. You don't see anything really anywhere in journalism that's constructive. You don't see any journalists talking about how do we solve these problems. It's all about invoking emotionality and fear, and journalists feed off of that, and that's what draws viewers. And so. That's part of the reason why we have such poor civil discourse, is because there's nobody out there in the media that is demonstrating how to engage in proper civil discourse. It's all about controversy. Peace does not sell in the world. Let me tell you something. Journalists hate peace. They hate it with a passion. The last thing they want to do is show a picture of people sitting around a peace table figuring out how to solve a difficult problem. They'd much rather show tanks rolling down the streets of Damascus, blowing people up, then show the potential of Bashar al-Assad sitting down with the rebel opposition group and trying to hammer out, what are we going to do here? No interest in that. Journalism has no interest in that. And so as a result, the people who, that's why I don't watch television, that's why I don't listen to the radio, because it's so slanted, doesn't matter whether it's liberal or conservative, it's so slanted towards fear that it pollutes our brains.
You know, I had the opportunity when I was visiting an older relative of my mother, as a matter of fact, who watches the nightly news every night. And, you know, that is gone from our society mostly. Nowadays, there really isn't a nightly news. Now, I know that people would often say it was slanted even when we used to watch it. But the thing is that what we call, quote, news, whether it's on Fox, MSNBC, CNN, wherever you're getting it, is no longer news. It's an opinion piece. It's just one opinion show after
right.
another, and you hardly ever get the news. You get maybe 2 minutes
right.
of the news, if you're lucky.
That's right. And even if you read the news, which I do, I read every day. I'm a voracious reader, and I've got my Google set up, so I pick news up from all over the world. So I'm getting all different kinds of inputs of what news is. But even then, when you read stuff, you very quickly realize that the people who are writing these articles, for the most part, don't know what they're talking about. And so you have to distill, you have to be very discerning and really be able to critically think your way through what's going on. And as I said earlier, our educational system has completely dropped the ball in teaching kids how to critically think. The reason is it's very hard to teach kids how to critically think. It takes a lot of work. It's very labor intensive. And it takes a great teacher to teach a kid how to critically think, and we don't have great teachers anymore. Teaching is, I mean, I know a lot of people are going to be insulted by this, but teaching has been relegated to the mediocre. You don't see Phi Beta Kappas going into teaching.
That's true.
They go into law, they go into medicine, they go into politics, but they don't go into teaching. Some do, but by far and away, the vast majority of teachers are good people, meaningful service, but if you look at their academic credentials and how good a critical thinkers they are, not there. Not
especially there. In the elementary and secondary school levels, I know
right.
that's true. The brightest people have to really be committed and essentially sacrifice a great many things to become a teacher.
And they become crushed. And they're crushed by the system because the conformity, the need to conform and be mediocre in the educational system in any given school district is intense. If you try to do excellent work in a school system, you're going to get crushed.
Absolutely,
so,
and I've seen it as a parent.
And especially in those districts where that are really interested in not teaching critical thinking, they're interested in teaching ideology. A teacher who has the desire and the capacity to teach critical thinking is crushed. You are not wanted here. Teach the company line or go away. So it's a huge problem, and I don't know what the answer is. It's just keep talking about it. I mean, and in the microcosm, in my work as a mediator and peacemaker, when I'm engaged in these deep conflicts, I face this problem in every single conflict. And what I have to do is take time to coach people how to hold multiple conflicting ideas in their heads at the same time, in the matter of eight hours or so. And help them figure out how to think about their problems in a very different way.
How generally willing? How much do you have to coax people to even get to that point? Because I know you talk about your first step is convening, which actually to me
right.
sounds like a pretty big step because they have
That's about 90%. Yeah, it's 90% of the work.
Yep, there you go.
If I can get people to the table, I won't say always, but if I can get people to the table, I've got a better than 85 to 90% chance that we're going to work out differences and really come up with a really, really amazing creative transformative solution to whatever the problem is. 85, 90% of the time, that's going to happen. 10% of the time, maybe not. Or it'll be suboptimal, it won't be perfect. I mean, less than 1% don't get some resolution. Some just don't, but that's very small. But the problem is getting people to the table. Because, again, when I go all over the country talking, and I talked I'm going to be talking up in Portland next week at Concordia, and I will guarantee you that after my talk, somebody will come up to me and say, gee, where were you 2 years ago? I was having this big fight with my brother and my sister. I really needed your peacemaking skills then. Well, I'm a really easy guy to find. I mean, I spend a lot of money on professional marketing so people can find me to solve those problems. But what I have found is that when people are in peace, they love the idea of peacemaking. But when they are in conflict or when they're in fear, they want to hire the meanest junkyard lawyer they can find. They want to get the biggest nuclear bomb they can find. They want to get the poison gas. They want to crush the other side. And peacemaking is the last thing that they want to do. It's a wimpy, cop-out, soft, kumbaya thing that will never work. I want to destroy my enemy. I don't want to make peace with him. My peace is a Colt 45. And that's how people think, and I hear this all the time, every day. So trying to talk people off the window ledge, so to speak, to the table is 90% of the work, and it's hard. It's hard.
Do you think people are being taught through their identity that compromise? You know, one of the things about when I look again, even back at that certain narrower viewpoints about the world, is that there is no compromise within some of those things. You know, not to just focus on that, but you either believe in this or you don't, and there's no compromise.
Right.
And so are people threatened by compromise itself, and is that the main reason? They're not willing to give up anything, so why even go to the table? Is that true of people?
Yes, it is true, because people think that the only way you can solve problems is by compromise, which means that you have to give something up that you value in order to get something back from the other side that you want. Well, that's just one of five ways of solving a problem. And and compromise can be effective, but it's also very primitive. There are huge myths and misunderstandings that people have around negotiation, around decision-making, around problem-solving, around mediation, and around peacemaking. And they think that the only way they can get peace or they can get is that they have to give something up, and if what they have to give up is their identity or a piece of their identity, well, there we are, back in the fear reaction. I'm not going to do that. What they don't understand is that by coming to the table and exploring all the alternatives and what defining the problem, understanding the problem, talking about the problem and how people have experienced it, tends to lend itself to solutions that don't require any compromise at all. When I'm working in family business conflicts, where family members are also owners or participants in a business, I tell every single one of them, if you compromise, you're making a huge mistake. Do not compromise anything. And people look at me like I'm crazy. And I said, no. We will find a solution to this problem that will not require you to compromise one thing. And they think I'm nuts. And then, you know, when we're done with the process, I said, did you compromise anything? No. Okay. And they're astounded. They're astounded that they can get what they want without having to compromise. But that is a very sophisticated level of work that most people have not been taught, have not been exposed to, and do not understand.
I wonder if people even understand what mediation really is, because I would say that, yeah, they obviously don't, because I would say the number one assumption, the number one thing is everyone, and I probably am included in that, although I did look at your book and I know that you talk about this. Your number one assumption is I'm going to have to give something up, and there's no hope of finding some solution that's greater than that. And, you know, nowhere do I think of this more than in what's going on within our governmental processes in the last couple years. You know, how there doesn't seem to be any discussion. It's just been shut down because there's this thought that you can't compromise on these issues. There's no coming together. And so they don't even talk. And that's really handicapping our society. I wonder if you could speak to that. How do we get to the point of healing what is really very important? Our government has become dysfunctional because of this in many ways.
There's an argument that says that it's good that our government is dysfunctional, because if it can't function, it can't interfere with our, you know, with our liberty.
We can get on that and the NDAA and all that too.
We have a huge financial crisis that we're dealing with, and we have a huge economic crisis within the government between the deficit and spending and stuff like that that's unsustainable. And so there has to be a way to work that. Okay, so why? There are times when compromise is the only way to solve a problem. There are other times when it is totally not the right way to solve a problem. And this is what we see in, for example, the Congress is extremely unsophisticated, primitive negotiators. They are extremely primitive in the way that they see the world. They think they're the most sophisticated, badass negotiators that exist. In fact, they are kindergartners.
Yeah.
In terms of their ability to negotiate and their ability to solve problems. They're kindergartners. They're no better than six-year-olds. And they have a schoolyard, that kindergarten schoolyard mentality about how to solve problems. And it's all ideology, and it's all about power. It has nothing to do with good public policy. Two things that I'll share with you that just demonstrate how bad this is. Once, in my capacity as president of the California Dispute Resolution Council, I have to go to Sacramento, the state capital of California, to talk with members of the legislature about policy issues around alternative dispute resolution. Time and time and time again, these guys tell me good public policy is not what we're about. What we're about is stopping the other party from getting anything done. We're all about getting power for ourselves and keeping the other side from having power. And if I ask them, well, what's the purpose of that power? They say, just to stay in power, just so we can get the benefit of being in power, not that we're going to use it for any good or anything.
Uh-huh.
And then when you look at the Congress, you see the same thing. Mitch McConnell stated right after Obama was elected 4 years ago, 3 years ago, when he was elected 4 years ago, just about 4 years ago, Mitch McConnell, who was the second in the Senate on the Republican side, said, did I get that right, Mitch? No, he's in the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm getting confused. I think it's the House of Representatives. He was the majority leader in the House, said, our job is to say no. My job is to make sure that Obama does not serve any more than one term as president. And we will do everything we can to make sure, and that's our only policy. Everything else, it doesn't matter. No matter what the Democrats say, we say no. There will be no compromise. There will be no negotiation. There will be no nothing. We want him out, and we will do everything we can. The Republican platform is get rid of Obama. Obama is a one-term president. And that's the way the Republicans have behaved ever since. And, you know, I mean, that's their policy, get rid of Obama. Well, that's not good public policy, but that's the way they think. And so it makes compromise or collaboration or accommodation impossible. It makes any kind of reasonable decision-making impossible because, you know, one side doesn't want to work. And so as long as they have that attitude, there's nothing anybody can do. And as long as you've got people out there that are measuring Republicans to some sort of weird ideological purity in terms of their thought, they're not going to do that because these guys love their jobs. They make the equivalent of, they don't get their actual salary as this, but when you consider all their perks and all the benefits they get, you know, they're making $400,000 to $500,000 a year as members of Congress. You know, the total value of everything they get, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so why would they give that up? It's an easy, cushy job. All you got to do is run for re-election every 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, rather, for the Senate. It's pretty darn cushy. And so why give it up? So that's how they toe the line.
Yeah. And you know, the irony of this is having listened to the conservative side of things, I know that they're – are Tea Partiers who have come to Congress who sincerely don't want all that, and yet they have their own agenda.
They get sucked right into it.
Yeah.
That's right.
And
it's not
really
just the Republicans, it's the Democrats too. I mean,
oh,
I don't
absolutely.
Mean to pick on the conservatives. The liberals are just as bad. So the system is the way that it is, and, you know, the idea of public service or working for a better government and trying to accommodate the diverse and sometimes conflicting needs of a very multicultural population is, for many of these people, very difficult to do. If you come from southern Wisconsin, lily white and archly evangelically conservative, and you've never held a job in your life, and other than being in government, you are not going to have an appreciation or an interest in solving the problems of the urban poor in New York City or Atlanta or Los Angeles. You're just not going to be interested in that. Those people don't exist because you've never experienced them before. And so it makes it very easy to say, you know, we're going to raise taxes and cut government spending because you've never had the experience of having to deal with those people and try to understand what their needs are.
You know,
and by the same token, if you've been on welfare all your life and have never held a job, it's very difficult for you to understand and appreciate the fact that people who create jobs, small business people around the world, I mean around the country, are oftentimes grossly overregulated and in some cases overtaxed, but not in all cases. But they face incredible, incredible burdens just trying to keep a business going. And the regulations that a small business person has to deal with is unbelievably bad. unbelievably bad how small businesses are overregulated. And so, but to the person who's the urban poor person, you know, they don't get that because that's not their reality. And so it's very difficult for them to understand the plight of the business person just trying to make a living and create a few jobs for people. So the problem is that people cannot comprehend the various perspectives that of other people who seem to be radically different than them.
I think that we're seeing surfaced this callousness that does exist, and it seems to be dividing the haves and the have-nots, so to speak. And yet, the irony of it is that people supporting, when you look at, say, the Republicans, which are viewed as this party of the corporate influence, yet that exists in both places. And there are plenty of have-not Republicans. I mean, the Tea Partiers, many of them are people in rural America. They don't have a lot of stuff. And yet I do hear, and I thought Clinton really hit on something last night in his speech, which I thought once it really got going, I thought he really, really nailed it. Some of the riffs there. There is just a basic lack of understanding. What is it really like to be poor? What is it really like when you go to the doctor and you have to pay for it, or you avoid going to the doctor, which is more likely, and a lot of small business people go through this. And I think that there is a fundamental lack of understanding. And then on the other side of the equation, it's hard for people to understand those who are born into privilege. And, you know, the interesting thing is their lives are not necessarily free of challenge. I mean, a lot of people who have been born into privilege, I mean, they can become just as depressed, just as dysfunctional, just as unhappy, just in a different way.
I see very few wealthy people who are happy human beings.
Yeah,
there you go.
And so there's this perception that, well, they're, you know, they've got everything, they've got it all. And the irony of it is they don't really see it that way. It's very rare for someone to be at peace with themselves in that way. And in fact, I've known well-off people that maybe they're seeing that maybe it would be better off if they didn't have to deal with all of this. And so there's an irony and a disconnect, and nobody really understands. And if we could all somehow find that we're all seeking, you know, to say it within our own country's words, you know, we're all seeking to be able to pursue happiness in this life in our own way, and that it can be found in multiple ways. You don't have to be rich. You can find happiness without having a lot of money, although if you're really in survival mode, of course, it's difficult. So where do we go? Where do we find this place? Because you almost feel like these rifts are just going to go on and on and on, and that if you looked up historical things as to what were Republicans and Democrats saying years and years ago, you'll find, you know, a lot of the same arguments were actually going on even then, and although the parties
sure.
have shifted to a degree.
Right.
So maybe I should just say conservatives and non-conservatives. So anyway, just where do we go? Where do we find this place?
Well,
where do we come to the table?
I don't think there's a solution here. It is a dynamic. Our culture is dynamic. It changes. We change with it. And, you know, the solutions that might be apparent to us today may be completely inappropriate 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. So I think the secret is learning, helping people think through their beliefs and the problems that they face and the conflicts they confront, and help them look at those problems with the clearest eyes and the clearest mind possible, parsing out the emotions, acknowledging their emotions, trying to understand where the emotion is coming from, what is triggering all of this, and then helping people make good choices. And they may choose to be one way or another, but if they choose after understanding the deep consequences of their choices rather than it just being unconscious reactivity, I'm okay with that. Today what we have is unconscious reactivity, and people are not recognizing the deep consequences of the choices they want to make. I mean, it's so funny to talk to Tea Party people. They say we want to go back to constitutional principles. And I say, well, what constitutional principles do you want to go to? and they can't name them. They have no clue. You know, I said, okay, so let's start with something really basic like the Bill of Rights. Let's start talking about the First and Second Amendment. You know, what part of that do you want to go back to that you think we've lost? How about the Patriot Act? The Patriot Act is grossly unconstitutional. It violates every one of the Bill of Rights. And yet no one's talking about that. Do you guys want to, does that mean that we repeal the Patriot Act? Well, no. Well, then how can, you know, I mean, so you get people to start thinking about this stuff, and then they get real resistant because they don't want to think. And they say, well, you damn lawyer, all you're doing is twisting words in my mouth. You can't, you know, I mean, it's not the lawyers
twist
words.
Then they distrust you. They make an assumption
about
you.
That's right.
You become right
an ad hominem attack, and all you're trying to do is point out to people the complexity of the problem. They're not trained in dealing in complexity. It creates huge anxiety in them because it's challenging their identity, as I said before, and so they shut down. I don't know what the solution is. I mean, all I do is try to work with people one-on-one, one day at a time, one conflict at a time, and hope by over a long, long career of doing this that I touch enough people that, you know, a critical mass gets started. I mean, and that's what drove us into the prison project and all this other stuff I've been doing is to try to, at a very grassroots level, get people to see that there are processes and ways of being that can solve problems if they're willing to learn how to do them.
In fact, I'd like you to be able to talk. I know we don't have a ton of time left, but we have a little bit. I think there is a lot of hope in that prison project. And, you know, one thing that came out in what you just said is how we assign identities to people. We may not only have our own identity, but we make
Absolutely.
An assumption what a lawyer is, what a Tea Party is,
right.
what a prisoner
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
And we assume
exactly.
that they're going to act in a particular way because of that identity that we are attributing
right. stereotyping.
To them. And that closes
it's stereotyping.
Up. Right.
And it's a mental
it
shortcut.
Is.
It's
and
an
so
emotion,
your
it's a mental and emotional shortcut designed to make to ease up cognitive metabolic process. And you know, I mean, if you think about evolution, it makes total sense. Supposing you're with your family clan and you're out in the plains of Africa somewhere and you see another clan approaching you, you need to size up very quickly, like instantly, are these people safe or are they dangerous? And so you
yeah.
stereotype we learn to stereotype based upon how close those people appear to be similar to us. If they're similar to us, they're probably safe. If they're dissimilar from us, they're dangerous until proven otherwise. And those people, those of our ancestors 250,000 years ago who made the wrong decisions and got too friendly too fast, got wiped out of the gene pool. So we've inherited this very paranoid set of genes that says whenever we look at somebody who's different, there's a set of unconscious processes that says they're dangerous until proven otherwise. And that's stereotyping. And it had a really beneficial adaptive purpose 250,000 years ago, but today it creates nothing but grief for us.
Now,
and
doesn't
it's all unconscious.
And
it's
isn't
totally
that what's led to things like the Patriot
of
Act,
course.
Or, you know, since
of
you
course.
Wrote your book, the National Defense Authorization Act, which
right.
is really frightening to a lot of people
right.
As
right.
to what that does.
Right.
It causes us to basically destroy our own society, the
That's
paranoia.
Right. That's right. That's
and
right.
How
so
do we
how do you deal
get
with this?
That?
You know, it's at the end of the day, it's educating our kids. It's teaching
yeah.
them to be free thinkers, and you know that doesn't mean that you don't teach kids values, whatever your value system is. It's critical to teach kids values, but you also have to give them the freedom to think about those values and think about their own lives and what values they want to create for themselves. And if you do a good job, they'll turn out fine. If you don't do a good job, well, maybe they'll turn out fine and maybe they won't. So, and the one thing that if you don't teach your kids critical thinkers, it's pretty darn sure we're gonna basically educate ourselves away from liberty and towards totalitarianism, because we don't have critical free thinkers in the Jeffersonian concept, and that's
yeah.
a huge problem.
And it could get to the point where we're not even allowed to teach our children to think freely.
Of course,
that would become subversive to teach your children to be free thinkers.
Right.
Which, you know,
and,
it's funny.
And you can see that we move in that direction because it's safer. It's emotionally safer to force an educational system onto kids that does not allow them to be critical thinkers. It's safer
yeah.
that way. It's dangerous.
And yet, it's irrational.
It's emotional. It's not irrational. Like, it's emotional. It's an emotional reaction to fear. And yet, you're going to destroy the very thing that you're trying to protect.
That's the irony of
freedom.
It. And I think there's nothing that comes through your book more powerfully than the fact that emotions rule us, not rationality. Even though we know, surely, somebody, you know, I will tell you, people are coming together in some ways over their concerns over the infringements of freedom in our
mm-hmm.
society. That is a topic which will bring diverse people together, ironically.
Right.
And you would think that our leaders could think rationally about this. But I'm beginning to think that there really isn't a lot of rational thinking going on. It's just this fear, and how do I protect? You know, some people will say there's this vast conspiracy, and I know there's a lot of theories out there, and I'm not going to go there.
Let me stop you right there, and then we'll go on to talking about how people protect their power, position, and privilege. Conspiracy theories is just the flip side of what we've been talking about. It's so much easier to explain a complex, ambiguous, gray, difficult, challenging world by a simple conspiracy theory, saying there's this cabal of the whoever,
yes.
you know, sit around the table and manipulate the world leaders, the one world order, whatever this stuff is called, and you know, it's so easy to say that because it solves all your problems. It's just the flip side of ideology. It's a simple solution to ease the anxiety of a difficult problem. And as I like to tell conspiracy theorists, you know, if there was some grand conspiracy out there, they sure are screwing up. Boy, what a bunch of idiots they are. I mean, look at our world. What a bunch of idiots. They haven't done anything right in 50 years. So let them do their conspiracy. They're not bothering anybody because they're idiots. And the conspiracy guys look at me.
Yeah, I don't think it's very coordinated. That is so true.
No, it's not. That usually shuts the conspiracy theory people right down. Like when they start thinking about it, they say, oh, you're right. They aren't doing a very good job. So,
I know we're kind of running out of time, but the classic, I just have to bring this up, is there was a lot of talk of what are they doing in the Bohemian Grove. I don't know if you're aware of that. And they have like some ritual or whatever. And, you know, when I look at that, some people see this really dark thing. I see a bunch of guys, most of them, I think they have to be guys, they probably were in fraternities where there are a lot of rituals, and they've got these other things that they've perpetuated. And yet people want to attribute this very dark, dark agenda, you know, even satanic, they'll use that term, you know, it's a satanic agenda, and, you know, use the most emotionally charged terms to attribute very, very dark motivations to people.
Right.
And how does that lead us to come together? When what I see is not that, I think that's very rare, honestly. I think it's extremely
rare
that people have that kind of dark agenda. And that if they've got some kind of ritual they've been doing since 1920, it's no different than in some fraternity where they have some ritual that they've been doing since 1920. There are tons of rituals in our society that don't mean anything. They're just kind of sentimental. I mean, it's just some sentimental thing they've been doing. So, you know,
back to hope, because I think hope is really important. And I want to talk just for a second about the Prison Project before we close out.
Yes, please.
The Prison Project started 3 years ago, and Laurel Copper, who's a mediator in Los Angeles, a very close, almost sister to me, and I, she received a letter from an inmate, and after a long process, I'm going to talk about this at Concordia. I'm going to tell the whole story next week, but basically we went in and we were invited in by inmates. These are not normal inmates. These are women who are serving life sentences without possibility of parole in the largest, most violent women's prison in the world. And they invited us in to teach them how to be peacemakers because they were tired of the violence in the prison. They knew they were going to be in there for life. Every single one of them is a murderer. Every single one of them committed a heinous, heinous crime. And yet they recognized they were in a community of violence and they were tired of it and they wanted to change. And believe it or not, we taught them how to be peacemakers. There are over 200 women have been trained now. Their violence in the prison has reduced dramatically. The women have stopped riots. They have mediated hundreds, if not thousands, of disputes. They do peace circles all over the prison. The whole place has completely changed. And there are amazing stories that have come out of this, but the thing that it validates is that even murderers can be effective, powerful peacemakers.
Yeah.
And You know, if I can train a murderer to be an effective peacemaker, what's wrong with the rest of us? You know, why are we so unwilling to do this work? And you know, it's a very, very powerful it's a very powerful testament to the power of, you know, having skills that allow you to sit and listen to people that you hate and work with them and to solve problems.
You know, I sense that they're very motivated because for them, the conflicts they get into are very visceral and threatening in their world. And somehow we need to find
their
the same motivation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We need to find the same motivation and realize that we, too, are threatened. Our children. Focus on the children. What kind of world do we want for our children? And if we could find that same motivation, there would be hope. And I find such tremendous hope within your prison project. And I hope that people study it. It's at prisonofpeace.org. I want to remind people as we're coming to the end that they can learn more about you there, the prison project, and then also elusivepeace.com. And that you will be speaking at Concordia College. Let's just remind everyone of that next week, September 13th at 7 p.m. And that's an open talk, correct? So
right.
I know that you welcome people to come.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about prison. I'm going to be talking about the Prison of Peace Project and using it as an illustration of, you know, what murderers can teach peacemakers. You know, I mean, it's very powerful, and it gives us all a lot of hope. The problem with children is that it's very easy to talk about teaching children and working with children and teaching them all these values, but when you get right down to the granular nitty-gritty of mom and dad having to work and the kids having to get to school at 6 a.m. and putting food on the table, there's very little elasticity in the normal American family to teach these deep values to kids, very little elasticity.
Yeah.
The kids are over-programmed, the parents are over-programmed, stressed out by money and everything else. I mean, it's wonderful to talk about it, but until we help people find the capacity to think about how to teach their children these skills, skills that the parents don't even have themselves, all we'll do is talk about it, and nothing will really change.
I guess when I mention the children, although I think it would be great to teach this, and probably there are some ways to do it, it's my motivation. I mean, being a parent and wanting a world for my child that is much better than this one, where people really have a hope of peace on earth,
right,
and that it's not because of some globalist agenda, to mention a conspiracy, but it's because we really want peace on earth. All the major
religions
talk
about it. And so how much time do you spend every week teaching, how much time do you spend, I'm not talking you specifically, but how much time do you spend every week teaching your children how to be peacemakers, how to deal with conflict, how to make good choices about do I respond violently to this or do I respond nonviolently to this? And what are my choices? What are my options? What are the consequences of my choices? How do I respond to all this? How much time do we really spend in a given week teaching kids collaborative problem solving? We don't. We don't spend any time at all. It's all hierarchical. You're the kid, I'm the parent. You're the kid, I'm the teacher. You're the kid, I'm the principal. You do what I say or else.
Yep.
But and that's what they learn. They learn that violence and power are the two big currencies for getting things done in the world. Violence and power are the two major currencies for getting things done in the world. That's what kids learn. That's what they're taught by their parents, their teachers, their principals, and other authority figures. And that's what they get off the television. Violence and power. Superpower Wonder Power Rangers Unite. I mean, look at all the violence in the movies and television. It's all about violence and power. It's not about peace. It's not about how to collaboratively problem solve. It's not about critical thinking. You don't see any kids, cartoon characters on Saturday thinking through a problem and thinking through the complexity of the problem. What you see is who's got the most power, and then they go beat up the bad guy. All violence. Violence is the solution to everything. Power is the solution to everything. That's what kids are taught.
Yeah,
and that's
and
all their parents
know,
because that's all their parents were taught. So,
well,
I mean,
it propagates.
Of course.
It's in the workplace, too. It's all about authoritarian structures and power.
It's everywhere.
There's not the collaboration.
It's the myth of redemptive violence that Walter Wink talks about. You know, the idea that violence redeems all evil. And the only way that we can protect ourselves is through the application of violence. Bruce Willis has made a fortune on the myth of redemptive violence. So Schwarzenegger and Stallone. I mean, made a friggin' fortune on this myth that permeates our culture. But does anybody ever talk to Bluto and find out why every week he's got to abduct and rape olive oil? Does anybody ever talk to Popeye and figure out why he doesn't eat the spinach when he sees Bluto? Does anybody wonder why olive oil is such a friggin' weak woman that she can't take martial arts lessons and learn how to defend herself against Bluto when she knows every week he's going to abduct her and rape her? Nobody ever talks about that around Popeye. You know, I mean,
I'll
come
tell
on.
You what. Well, you know, and there are some new icons coming in, and we're about to run out of the live broadcast. I'm going to let us go about a minute into overtime for the archive audience. But, you know, there is some hope. When I see things like my kid watched Avatar, which was a cartoon
horrible
based
movie.
On some Eastern.
Horrible movie.
Well, the movie
horrible
was horrible,
movie.
But it was based on an entire cartoon series that actually had some higher things in it. It wasn't
this movie
all,
is all
like
about
what we
violence.
Were taught. But you're
I watched
right.
Avatar.
There was a lot of violence.
Beautifully
well,
done.
That's the
I love
movie.
The cinema. Cameron did a great job cinematography, but that movie was a perfect example of the myth of redemptive violence.
Yes.
Perfect example of how violence overcomes everything. You have look at the storyline. It's classic. You got these Earth people on this beautiful planet, and they're extracting this mineral that's needed for everything. And so the only way that they can deal with the indigenous people is through violence. And so what do the indigenous people do? They come back and they're counterviolent. And it's only the counterviolence that solves the problem. There's nothing there about negotiation, nothing about compromise, nothing about trying to understand each other's problems. It's all about who's got the most power when and who's going to win. And at the end of the day, we feel good because Gaia. I mean, I walked out of that movie and just shaking my head. I said, here it is again. You know.
Well, I'll say that I had some hope when the series is much longer. I mean, it goes on. I don't know. There's several seasons of it. And one of the things about it that, you know, some of the most powerful stories, Doug, have to do with someone on the other side, the quote other, whoever, whatever that other is,
right,
coming over to your side. Now, granted, there's still sides, but that does happen. I don't think it really was reflected much in the Avatar movie because it was just so short. But the series actually does explore that, where they're the people who are on a different side. They have internal conflicts over their own ideology, and it brings them over. And so there is some hope when I see that. But you're right. In the end, what happens? It's all about destruction and power and you know, exerting your form of power over someone else. And that is true. And that's where we still haven't gotten past that fundamental.
As long as the kids are exposed. As long as the kids are exposed to that, we're going to continue to have that kind of mentality being propagated into the generations ahead of us. So I challenge people. I say, if you really want a peaceful world, stop exposing kids to that kind of entertainment. Take away the television sets. Take away the radios. Take away the movies. I haven't been to a movie in 5 years. I don't own a television set. Don't own a radio. Don't watch any of that stuff.
Well, what about the gaming? You know, nowadays,
gaming. I mean, I know about it.
Militaristic games.
Yeah, it's extremely violent. Extremely
violent. There's said to even be an agenda behind that, as if it's a form of training. You know, these kids. I used to say this is a horrible thought, but you know, if these kids ever get drafted, they're going to be perfectly trained to do any number of things. And you know, it
and
is.
And then they come back into society and
here.
They suicide. You know, we're losing, and they come back
horrible.
Because they're completely deprogrammed. And this is another horrible secret. Time Magazine did a story on this, and I did a radio show on it a couple months ago. There is somebody in the military committing suicide every single day.
Yeah.
Every single day. Multiple suicides.
Yeah. It's a tragedy. Well, they're being deployed over and over, and we are distanced from war. The population has become distanced from it.
The point of all this is there are just many, many indicators that suggest that the way that we're doing – if we talk about peace but we don't take any action, there are many, many things we could do to make a more peaceful world that would not change our lives one bit except to make it better, and yet we choose not to do those things.
Yeah.
There are reasons why we choose not to do those things, and it would be there. And that elusive peace was all about opening up a conversation around that. Okay, why is it that we have war? Why is it that Syria is in this civil war? Why did the Arab Spring not fulfill its great promise? You know, and why is it that the Iranians are the way they are? If we start having a conversation about this and begin to understand it, we can find a better way to do it. It's just that people aren't motivated because. You know, they see it as being too challenging, too difficult, too whatever, or they're being programmed by the media to not even think about that kind of stuff. So it's a challenge. It's a huge challenge.
It is. And, you know, my only hope is that when as things are becoming more challenging, or so they seem. This isn't the first time in the world that things have become challenging.
No.
But sometimes it's through, well, not just sometimes, it is challenge that often leads, it can lead to the worst things in society, the absolute worst. And we're seeing that expressed. And it could also lead to transformation. And that's where I place my hope is, you know, what you saw in the Prison Project, that there is fundamental goodness in people. And, you know, you mentioned this in your book, too, that a lot of times people assume, there have been old assumptions that people are fundamentally bad, and that makes us distrustful. But if we can only come to the point of seeing that fundamental goodness, you know, I challenge people, go listen to the most objectionable person you can imagine and find something good about it, you know. And I bet you could. You can find
it
if you look.
Absolutely.
And find their humanity. So, you know, I appreciate what you're doing. I wish that a whole bunch of mediators like you would head on to Washington and help these people.
The sad thing is they don't want anything to do with us.
No, of course not.
It's been offered. Believe me, some very high-level people have offered to help, and the political leaders say, nope, go away. Same thing with the diplomats. I mean, the diplomats want nothing to do with peace. They want nothing to do with the skill sets we're talking about. So it's sad, but that's the problem.
Very sad.
It's been a great conversation.
It has. And thank you so much for coming back to the show. And, you know, again, I'll give you one more opportunity to go ahead and let people know where they can find you. Just leave them with some final details about
if they want to learn about the book and some of my ideas around international conflict and peace and why we're having so many problems, go to elusivepeace.com. Prison Project is prisonofpeace.org. And check out the videos on the Preston Media page. That's where you should really start. And then if you're interested in finding out more about my professional work, you can go to probably NoelAssociates.com would be the best place to go, my mediation site. I've got a bunch of other websites. If you can't write all that stuff down, just Google Doug Noel, N-O-L-L. You'll learn more about me than you ever want to know.
And I'm happy to add more to the show page, too, because we have links that can go off to various locations. So I'll be on the lookout for those and put some more out there for people.
Right. Great.
Well, thank you again, Doug. I look forward. I hope to attend your presentation
next week. I'll see you next week then. Perfect.
Yeah, I'm really, really hoping
to
be there.
Sure to stop in. And great.
Yeah.
Very good.
And so thanks so much. And I hope to see you again sometime on the show. It seems like we have no end of things to talk about.
Anytime. I'm happy to come back.
All right. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Take care. Bye.
You too. Okay, just a couple final details as we end today's show. I want to encourage people to visit the Frontier Beyond Fear website to see what upcoming guests we have. We have quite an interesting schedule coming together for the fall, and that website is www.frontierbeyondfear.com. And you can also contact the show at info@frontierbeyondfear.com. So coming up on Saturday night, we have a more lighthearted show where I'm going to have intuitive Debbie Griggs. She's going to talk about her spiritual journey and then also give some guidance to callers that night. So that's 7 p.m. Pacific on Saturday night. And then next week, we've got two guests coming up. We've got Bill Foss, who is quite a visionary in the spiritual community, and he's going to talk about his path and successful strategies for life. So he'll be here Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific. And then Friday, we actually have Doug Noel's wife, who is Alea Dow, who is very accomplished. Both Doug and Alea have been on this show quite recently talking about their relationship seminars, how you can apply peacemaking within relationships. And Alea is a gifted healer who comes from that perspective. And Alea will be talking about that and some ways of raising consciousness within our own lives, and what we do in our own lives translates to the world. So really looking forward to that. And just a note that we do welcome support from listeners. I don't usually say this, but I'm going to start just mentioning it, that to support this ongoing show, I welcome your support. And if you want to learn about how to do that, just go to frontierbeyondfear.com. So thank you very much for being here. And I look forward to an entire series of high consciousness conversations coming up over the weeks to come. Mm-hmm.